One of the Rolling Stone magazine's top 500 tunes of all time, Brooke Benton, Rainy Night in Georgia. Now, from the UK rock circuit to stages around the world, and now right here in Ballito, Steve Graham is a seasoned performer who shared the stage with legends like Sting, Bryan Adams, and Tina Turner. And with decades of international experience and passion for rock, and classic rock at that, his show Monsters of Rock now brings the music of icons like Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd roaring back to life. My very great honor to welcome Steve Graham to the Dave Charles Show on this happy Tuesday morning. It's lovely to have you along. If you want to bang your headphones on, you can be able to hear probably a little bit better.
If I must, I will.
There we go.
Oh, your voice sounds even better.
Well, you see what we're talking about here. Steve, your CV reads incredibly. And I'm sure that there are many that have read this CV and said, yesterday, you know, in South Africa. This is an international star among us.
I wish.
and I'm sure that for many, there is the question that I'm going to ask you to kick off the show. Why are you here?
I'm basically here. I come here to retire. That was the initial plan. Originally, I'm going to give you the backstory. I was originally a musician for many, many years, till I was about 34 years of age. Then I quit music, pretty much quit music. And I set up my own company in Dubai. So I'm in Dubai for almost 20 years. Leading up to me quitting music was because my manager had died. And for years, well, since I was 15 years old, up to that point, we were trying to hit the big time. We were trying to get record deals and, you know, hit the circuit. And we just, for some reason, we just timed it wrong. We're old rockers. And when we come out, it was early 80s. And it was Depeche Mode. And guys were makeup. And we were still dinosaurs from the 70s and the 80s. So, the really early 80s. So you didn't have the odd band breaking through, like your Bon Jovi's and stuff, and Def Leppard. So we still thought there was a bit of a chance, but
Guns N' Roses. Wow.
Yes, all that stuff. But unfortunately, at the time we were trying to get a major record deal, they were looking for that type of artist. And you know, it's very different now, the landscape. You can put stuff on YouTube, Spotify, all this stuff. We had to rely on a guy coming to see you and hoping you were good enough for him to recommend signing to a label.
Yeah.
So in those days, you were actually at the hands of one person, because he would recommend coming back to see you again or moving forward. If they didn't like what they heard, and they were generally young kids as well. I mean, we were young at the time as well. So they needed them scouts to find the next thing to sell records. In those days, we used to sell records, if you remember, Dave.
I remember very well.
So for me, it was when my manager died, I said, I quit music completely. I'd achieved a lot, but I hadn't achieved the end goal. And I, in my head, it was like, well, that didn't work. You know, after years, 20-odd years, that didn't work. So I then set up my own company. And funny enough, we were in Dubai. We set up radio stations, TV stations, production, documentaries. So I was doing a lot of work for National Geographic, Discovery Channel, movies, jingles, you know, all that stuff. So I kept my hand in music, but I wasn't actually performing live. And it wasn't until the end of my Dubai days I started playing again with a Middle Eastern band, all the international guys working in the band. Some big guys had worked with Neil Diamond and, you know, the Thompson Twins, and there was another guy that worked for Crowded House, a Kiwi lad. So they were all seasoned pros that we were working with. But it was like a corporate circuit. But great fun. I mean, geez, the gigs we were doing there were 30,000. We could do 30,000. We're down to 5,000-6,000 people. So it wasn't a Mickey Mouse outfit by any stretch of the imagination. But it got my hand back in. And then towards end of 2015, 2016, it was time to call it a day. And that's okay. How we ended up. My wife is South African. So that's how we ended up in South Africa.
But why did you choose Ballito? Because, and I asked that question for fairly good reason. Firstly, we're here, and you're here. But it's not the cultural center of anywhere, really. I mean, there's very little in terms of of theatre or art or even music for that matter. There's a little bit of live music at the Lifestyle Centre, thank heavens for that, but not much else going on. So it's an interesting place to base yourself.
Well, to be honest, I had a lot of South African friends in Dubai. In fact, the majority of my friends were South African. Obviously, your wife is your social secretary, isn't she? So it was a lot of stuff as I was dealing with. But a lot of the guys were coming to their sort of retirement age, and they were saying, where are you going to go? What are you going to do? Ask them the same question. And a couple of my friends moved to Bolito. Said, no, if you like the climate in Dubai and you want the warm weather, then they suggested Bolito. So that's how I ended up here. I had mates from Dubai here. Oh. So we ended up in, you know, in hindsight, when we did this, I was looking to retire. So I wanted a nice spot. Yeah, Bolito wasn't anywhere near as busy 10 years ago when I arrived. You know, this had changed. This wasn't like this. It changed significantly in the last 10 years since I've been here. So for me, it was a little bit of a sleepy, relaxed lifestyle, which I did seek at that time.
Wow.
But the only thing is, Dave, I was here 18 months and I got so bored.
Well, I think it's an indisputable fact that if you are a musician or a performer of any description, there is something in your soul that needs to play, that needs to perform, that needs to create. And I've got a couple of tunes lined up and ready to go that I have not heard because they literally were loaded for this interview. And I presume they're originals, are they?
They're all originals, yeah. Yeah.
So the interesting thing about musicians, many musicians, is that they want to perform original music because that's, you know, and frown on playing covers, which you don't. I mean, you're very happy to play covers. And I think that, well, you can explain much better than I could, but what is your philosophy about playing covers as opposed to originals?
For me, originals, when you're trying to make the big time or you're trying to get a record deal, for me, that was what you had to do. But you still had to learn from the covers. Even when I was doing original material with my manager, and we were still doing covers. Because for me, you learn from the covers. You learn, if you're a guitar player, which I am, you learn style. You learn a singing style. You also learn lyrics. You learn melody. You learn lots of stuff by doing covers. Yeah. I feel, anyway. I mean, we all start playing covers, generally.
Well, I was thinking about this because I know musicians that frown on playing anything other than original. And I say it's so hard to connect with an audience when they don't know your music. They've never heard the song. They've got no connection to it. You're going to lose them. Why don't you start with a good tune that people know? Play it. Give it your spin. Pay homage to the original. Make it your own. But, you know, there's that connection. Oh, no. That's a sellout. I don't think it is. I don't think there's a classical musician that goes to study music for years that has ever said, I'm not going to play someone else's music because all the classics are someone else's music.
Absolutely.
And they love it. And we love it as well. And we love when you play the Monsters of Rock collection. But let's take a musical interlude. By the way, for those that are listening to this and wondering what a cover is essentially a song that has been produced by someone else, an original that you like and you play because you love the song and hopefully you give it something new. That's what a cover is anyway. But we're going to take an interlude with one of Steve's originals. It's called A Monday Morning Blues. What's the background?
Background, woof, this was towards the end of my writing career. And at the time, there was the Oasis and these type of bands coming out. Now, for me, we were this heavy classic rock, not heavy, but classic rock type band, typical, you know, inverted commas. But we tried a different direction with this. So this one sounds it's a bit more indie rock than classic rock. So this was a little bit of an experiment which we recorded in London. Actually quite liked the result of it because it was just so different from the stuff I'd done previously. Though very similar anyway.
Steve Graham, Monday Morning Blues, an original composition. I presume I'm assuming, because I recognize your guitar style. Did you overdub all the guitars on there, or did you play with a group of session musicians?
It was a band. Ah. Yeah, it was a full band. The solos were overdubbed.
Okay.
But the actual core of the song was done live.
And I noticed you mixed the vocals quite far back in the mix.
Yeah.
Is that your style?
No, I like it that way.
The J.J. Cale style.
Yeah, I do like it that way.
Well, I'm in conversation with Steve Graham. He's the most accomplished musician I've ever had on the Dave Charles Show, and it's a privilege and an honor to be able to chat to a musician that has performed more, I think it's fair to say, more professionally, and I use that word in the right sense of the word, because you have been a working musician in the hardest part of the century, in the hardest part of the firmament, you know, the international UK scene. To break in there and to have had any kind of success whatsoever is an absolute credit to you. And you played with some of the... Who are the big names that you appeared on stage with?
If I could digress a little bit to give you a bit of to put it into context, I was 15 years old and I was playing in a bar in Newcastle, which is where I'm from, Newcastle upon Tyne in the UK.
Newcastle on Tyne.
So we're called Geordies there.
Where the fog comes from.
Absolutely. Fog on the Tyne. They're band called Lindisfarne, old Geordie band, lovely guys. So I was playing this bar and a big guy come up to me and says, I want to come and see me on Monday morning. Now, there was rumours in the hall of who he was and what it was all about. Anyway, I went to see him. It's a guy called Chas Chandler. Now, he was in a band in the 60s called The Animals, who were also from Newcastle in the northeast. In 1967, The Animals split up, and Chas went into management. And the first act he found and managed was Jimi Hendrix.
Wow.
And Chas was also a record producer. So he produced the first two albums with Jimi Hendrix Experience. He produced them records as well. So when I saw him, it was like, oh, wow, this is such an opportunity of what he's done. Plus, he had a massive success with a glam rock band in the 70s called Slade.
Whoa.
So that was his... He found them again and made Slade what they were. He was the one that came up with the ideas of changing all the words so that they're spelled phonetically and not correctly. And he had so much... hassle with school teachers in the UK because of the spelling, and the kids were spelling, you know, what was on the record. So he had a different way of working. He was old school, very hard taskmaster, and I learned a hell of a lot from him. So he took me on board basically and to now get a record deal. I was 15 turning 16, and then we tried and tried and tried and tried. That's a long story, but you keep going back. And in between that, you're doing opening for acts. And because Charles Savvy's influence, let's get that right as well. It's not like, yes, I did it all on my own. No, no. You get a lot of help. But because Charles' influence, for instance, Sting is from Newcastle. So it was always support your own type of thing. You know, Brian Ferry, Roxy Music, is from Newcastle. Brian Johnson, AC/DC, from Newcastle. So these guys, Mark Knopfler, that's it. So we managed to get on these tours with, whether it be the European leg or just the British leg, sometimes just one-off shows. But we got in with all these acts to open for them. So what an and we were doing this in the mindset of one day we'll have our own record deal and we will, you know, go on to be mega famous, blah, blah, blah. That's the whole point of doing them. For me, it just lasted a lot longer because when we didn't break because of the 80s and the boys wearing makeup and Duran Duran and all these people, we kept doing the openings. And the head guys, the big acts would take us because we had a history of being, you know, polite, on time, not getting in the way, doing a good job, you know, in front of their audiences.
I want to ask you about playing opening acts for big names. Mm. Is it true that they give you only half the lights and half the sound?
Depends who you're with.
Oh. who was the best and who was the worst?
Depends who you're with. It's you know what? It's not actually all down, 99% of the times, not down to the act, not down to the artist. So like Sting, for instance, it's down to his sound crew. Now, whether he's given narrative to the sound boys and the lighting boys to go, just keep it. I don't understand why. They're the headline act. They want to shine. They don't want you to outshine them, if it's at all possible. So it happened a couple of times, but not often. But it did happen a couple of times.
But so you could literally play a gig where the audience preferred you to the headliner.
I wouldn't say that, no. That's
you're being modest.
No, I wouldn't say that. But we 9 times out of 10, we would go down really well. Because you've got to bear in mind, you know, when somebody buys a ticket, you know, we can get onto this with the shows I'm doing. When somebody buys a ticket, they have a different mindset to, for instance, playing at the Market or Eat Street. They're coming for dinner, they're coming to meet friends, they're coming to talk, and then a bit of entertainment, it's fine. When you're buying a ticket, you come up to watch that show. Now, when we were opening for people, they're coming to watch Bryan Adams, or they're coming to watch Tina Turner, or Sting, or whoever it is, they're up for it. You've really got to be bad. I mean, a terrible act to fail. Because the minute you walk in, you get a massive round of applause from the auditorium or the stadium.
Because the house is amped for the main attraction.
Yes.
So it can be quite a...
You feed off that.
Yeah.
You feed off that, yeah.
And that, I would imagine, is fairly addictive because, you know, we all want to be loved and accepted and have the respect and the recognition for who we are and what we are. And I think musicians performing live get that instantly. But you can also, and I wanted to ask you about this, because you now specialize in solo performance. You're a one-man act. You go out there on your own, and you carry the full weight. You, as a performing musician, are exposed and kind of naked in the spotlight, so to speak, you know, euphemistically, putting your heart and soul into your work. Audiences, traditionally, I think it's fair to say that in many instances, you're playing to houses that are not possibly fully attentive. Sometimes people have had too much to drink and they're a little bit of streperous and sort of ignoring you. How do you keep your spirits up? Because when you're playing in a band, you've got each other. So it really doesn't matter. I mean, hopefully it's all going down well, but you've got each other to bounce off and you might not be feeling great tonight, but your mate will pick you up. When you're on your own, that's it. How do you keep your spirits up?
You sort of switch off from the audience if it's like that. You switch off and you just get inside what you're doing. And it's like anything, you find the bits. If you have to learn a song, you're not pretty, you know, you don't like it so much. Yeah. Then you find the bit that does rock your boat, does get them, I'm waiting for that bit then. You know, it's a mindset to just not actually, you're not ignoring the audience, but you're mentally shutting down. If you're getting zero reaction, it's not great, then you have to shut down. You just got to get through the gig.
And does that happen?
Yeah. Yeah. It happens more when you, what I call you, when you're doing the street gigs, when you're doing the pub gigs and the street gigs, because it's, again, when you're selling a ticket, they come up to see you or see what you do.
Yeah.
When you're not selling tickets, it's, you're getting a Neil Diamond fan, an opera fan, you know, you name it. And you're getting people that actually don't want to hear music because they just want to eat and talk to Dave.
Yeah.
So you have all them challenges. So to be honest, when you're doing this, I used to, because when I first come to Bolito, I hadn't done this sort of thing. I know it sounds like I'm putting it down. I'm not. I just hadn't done a lot of that at all.
And this, you're talking about playing at the Lifestyle Center in the Market and
yeah, just playing in a restaurant.
General music for background music.
I hadn't sort of been exposed to a lot of that. So when and I come on late, and then you very quickly realise that. put your hands down and carry on. So I am a performer, rather than a guy that plays music. It's more an entertainer than a guy that plays music. You know, people want to always pigeon, great guitar, man, great skit. They always want, the end of the day for me, say anything that you watch, it's entertainment. If you go away from that going, wow, I feel good. Yeah. To me, I used to be a musical snob. I did. So you do go through that. But as I got a bit older, it was like, well, if he can do the same job doing that, and I've just put a full band together, I'm earning £3, he's earning £300, and the audience is loving that. What? Why? You know, you sometimes do things to feed your own ego. a lot of it, the time we are feeding our ego, but sometimes it's like, no, I must have a live band. It's, and I've done all that. So for me, like standing here playing it, look, I still do these gigs. It keeps my voice right. I still enjoy doing them. Thankfully, a lot of the time, some people do come to see me. So you've got somebody to feed off a little bit. And it's a great opportunity for young kids as well. You know, so it's,
and you put on a show. I mean, despite the fact that you're, as you say, playing street music, mm-hmm. which I think is, you're being modest, you go the extra mile. You bring your own lights. Your sound is good. Your equipment is really top notch. And we'll get into that in a sec. But why don't we take a listen to another one of your originals? This one's called "There Is Only One." Is this a song that you wrote about you?
No, I wish. It could be. No, it's actually a song I wrote in about 2001. And it was, I had the idea of the song, but the song was almost done, but not quite finished. And then I got asked by Jeep Middle East, did I have anything to launch their whole Middle East campaign, cinema, TV, radio. So I put a few songs together and they chose this one. And they goes, we want this. So then it was cut down and made "There's Only One," and that was the strap line for Jeep.
Get back to that in just a sec. It's another Steve Graham. It's called "Like I Believe It," but I've kind of overrun from the original tune. We were having such a nice conversation off air. So let's come back to that in just a sec. But right now, I'm back in conversation with Steve Graham on 88FM on the Dave Charles Show. And Steve, thanks for giving us so much of your time. I know this interview is possibly going on too long, and I won't take you much longer, but I want to find out about your equipment. You clearly have had the opportunity to play a range of guitars, and you're a guitarist by choice and profession. Do you play any other instruments?
Yeah, keyboards, bass, drums. That's about it.
But when you're playing live, it's guitar.
When I'm playing live, it's guitar, yeah.
Being a bit of a techno fan, shall we say, there are various different guitar styles that the pros tend to swear by. And it kind of largely falls between the humbuckers and the single coils. What is your choice of weapon?
Well, before the audience falls asleep during this technical stuff, for me, I've had Stratocasters, Les Pauls, Takamine, you name it. I've had everything. I've still got quite a few of them. But the older you get, the less, for me anyway, the older I got, the less concerned I was whether somebody saw me with a Fender or whether it was a Squire. If the thing sounded good, then I used it. You know, I really didn't care. I did when I was younger. Obviously, it was a big statement thing to have Fenders, and especially in the 70s, you were like, "Woof, well, that's expensive. You must be okay." As I got older, I started to cut back on this stuff, and I ended up getting a guitar called a Gordon guitar. It's a Canadian guitar, and it works with a piece of equipment, a foot pedal board which has lots of effects, reverb, echo, that sort of thing on, called a GR55 made by Roland, but it's a guitar synthesizer. And with that, you can model your guitar. So the actual sound of this guitar that I have is not actually what you're going to hear. I go into this.
So you can play a Gibson, a Fender, a Gretsch, exactly. Anything you like,
exactly.
through your Godin with a foot pedal.
Exactly.
Brilliant. It's the way things have changed, yeah. Phenomenally so. And I wonder sometimes, you know, the collector's market, you get these very, very expensive guitars that, I'm sure that they definitely have a spot on the wall now, mostly. Mm-hmm. But I've noticed the last couple of years, really good, but like the car market, you know, there's not a bad car on the market at the moment, but all these new Chinese and Indian cars coming out, they're really, really good. Value for money, you know. Mm-hmm. The experts will always, or the aficionado will always say, "Ah, yes, but it's not quite this thing." I noticed that some of the big acts that we talked about, J.J. Cale, he always played a kind of unknown guitar. Kenny Henson, who was a South African legend, always mm-hmm. played an unknown. And their take was, "Listen, it's not the guitar; it's the guitarist. It's not the instrument; it's what you do with it." So pretty much your style.
To a degree. I mean, this setup for me now, as you know, I do tribute shows, and I travel around South Africa and underworld playing them. I do a Pink Floyd tribute show, Plug Plug, and a Monsters of Rock. Now, with Pink Floyd, for instance, Dave Gilmour has so many different sounds within that catalogue, that history of Pink Floyd music, that I actually have 30 different settings, sounds, to do the Pink Floyd show.
Because he would use different guitars for each one. And clearly then you'd need a whole bunch of guitar techs and roadies bringing you on and tuning and other difficult thing.
Exactly.
So you've managed to achieve that with the pedal and...
It took me about 3 months to program it. This isn't something which you just plug in. It takes a long time. You've got to have patience, but it's worth it. The payoff's worth
it. But it is live.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's all live.
Because there are those that say, well, you know, these guys don't play live anymore. They all play to click tracks, and it's like karaoke.
Well, look, this show, because it is a one-man show, and that was born out of necessity, because trying to put a band together was an absolute nightmare, and especially at my age now, in my 60s, you've got guys that can't make the rehearsal or can't come to Cape Town that month and do the tour. And I just got so fed up when I was putting this thing together. I went, that's it. I'm just going to do this on my own. My wife said, well, how are you going to do it on your own? I said, what I'm going to do is I record all the music, record all the instruments. So you can't buy any of this stuff off the shelf. So it takes me around about 10 to 11 months to put one of these shows together. Maybe it's 12 months to put these shows together. And I record all the music first. I record it in a studio. So it was played live at one point. But then, obviously, I take it with me and it's played to video backing and all sorts. And then I play the live vocal and the live guitar on top of that.
So it is pretty much the international experience. When I say international experience, I know that there are management now that will not allow an act to go out and play live. It just won't. There's too many variables, and you need the act to sound as good as, if not better, than the recording. So that makes a lot of sense. Where are your shows happening for the next couple of months?
We're off to Johannes Pretoria at the end of May, and then Hearties I'm going to in May, in Johannesburg generally. Then we are off to Cape Town in June/July for 3 weeks, which we've just been in January, February. Now we go back June, July time. And then after that, we're on the East Coast in September, August. I'm going to Germany to do shows there. So, yeah, there's a lot going on. And in between that, I'll be popping up here at Lifestyle.
You're playing here.
How
amazing is that? You can hear Steve Graham at the Lifestyle Center regularly. And, you know, he's an international flipping diamond. It's your opportunity to just happen to pick up the right day, the right gig, and you'll find him playing at either the Eat Street Precinct or the Market. Brilliantly, if I might just add.
And
we're all terribly jealous, because he's by far the most accomplished guitarist in, I think, the province of KZN, probably the entire country. Steve, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you. Thank you so much for spending time. We're going to play out with one of your tunes called Like I Believe It. What's the background story there?
You know what? I'm going to get the pronunciation wrong. My English isn't great. My Afrikaans and Zulu is worse. The Limpopo Vovo Choir, is it? They were on America's Got Talent from Limpopo.
Okay.
So I saw this on the TV, these guys singing, and your listeners will know who I'm talking about. They were absolutely amazing. And I thought, what a song to bring, being South Africa, being the Rainbow Nation and all this philosophical stuff and, you know, sentimental. I thought, wouldn't this be a good song? So I actually specifically wrote it with that in mind. And it's just about, it's quite a, as you hear, it's a departure from what I normally do. It's more of a, an anthem type song.
Did you play it to the Ndlovu Youth Choir at all?
We sent it, but they didn't. They didn't realize that.
They're lost.
We don't care who you are. We're not playing it.
My very special guest, Steve Graham, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Dave. Thanks so much.